Envision this. You are a pediatrician in an outpatient clinic. Today, you are seeing a 13-year-old healthy boy who's been playing soccer for several years without any issues. His parents are concerned that he asked to be taken out of the game last weekend because he felt tired and dizzy. The patient's parents also tell you that his coach informed them that their son set out all of practices this week as well. His appetite seems fine and he drinks lots of water. He's constantly in the bathroom, his mom laughs. His weight is down 10 pounds since his sports physical 6 months ago, but his exam is otherwise normal. You are concerned for your patient's sudden change in health status, so you order some basic lab studies. And you find a serum glucose level of 287 and urinary dipstick test that is positive for glucose. Welcome to Audio Bricks. This is Ed Barnes breaking down diabetes mellitus foundations and frameworks in your ears. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Define type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. 2. Compare and contrast the pathophysiology and the clinical presentation of type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. 3. Compare and contrast diabetic ketoacidosis and hyperglycemic hyperosmolar non-ketotic syndrome as complications of diabetes mellitus. 4. Describe laboratory tests that help distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. And lastly, 5. Compare and contrast management principles for type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. Part 1. What is diabetes mellitus? Blood glucose is proof that you can have too much of a good thing. While glucose serves as a critical role as fuel for many of our bodily functions, it must remain in a very tightly controlled range. If the level of glucose is too low, you can fall into a coma. If glucose is too high, damage to tissues throughout the body can occur. When blood glucose is consistently too high, the mechanisms that return it to the normal range fail. This is called diabetes mellitus. Nearly 10% of the U.S. population has a form of diabetes, so it is critical that physicians understand the disease and be prepared to care for patients with the diagnosis. Diabetes mellitus is a condition characterized by a lack of insulin-mediated blood glucose control. Insulin is a hormone released by the pancreatic beta cells in the islets of Langerhans, which make up the endocrine portion of the pancreas. Just a quick reminder, we're only talking about the endocrine pancreas here. This is the portion that secretes hormones into the blood. The exocrine pancreas is responsible for some aspects of digestion, as it secretes enzymes into the duodenum to help break down carbohydrates, proteins, and lipids. But it's the endocrine pancreas that's involved in diabetes mellitus. There are two major forms of diabetes mellitus. In type 1 diabetes mellitus, the pancreatic islet cells undergo autoimmune destruction, resulting in inadequate or no insulin release to regulate the patient's glucose levels. This form presents most often in children. In type 2 diabetes mellitus, the body's response to insulin is decreased. This decreased response is referred to as insulin resistance. The body's cells are not properly able to respond when insulin is released to lower the blood glucose level. At the same time, the endocrine pancreas is deficient and cannot raise the insulin levels to compensate for the insulin resistance. This leads to an elevated level of glucose in the blood, and type 2 diabetes presents most often in obese adults. But obese children and even non-obese patients can get it too. Time for a quick quiz. What is the term for when the body's response to insulin is decreased? Insulin resistance. Part 2. Pathophysiology of diabetes mellitus. Although type 1 and type 2 diabetes are both characterized by hyperglycemia, each disease reaches this state by very different mechanisms. Type 1 diabetes results from an autoimmune destruction of the pancreatic islet cells, a type of immune hypersensitivity reaction. The destruction is from both antibodies, specifically autoantibodies against islet cells, and by cell-mediated immunity, which is when CD8 lymphocytes invade the islets, specifically targeting and killing the beta cells. In contrast, type 2 diabetes mellitus occurs due to a mix of insulin resistance and inadequate islet cell insulin secretion. The cause of insulin resistance is still unclear, but is correlated with obesity, sedentary lifestyle, high triglycerides, inflammation, and secretion of certain cytokines by the adipocytes. Envision, if you will, an obese patient with many more adipocytes. This increase in adipocytes leads to an increase in free fatty acid, adipokine secretion, and widespread inflammation, which all coalesce to a resultant insulin resistance. In compensation, initially the insulin resistance leads to an increased release of insulin by the pancreatic beta cells. At this point, the patients may have a normal or elevated blood glucose level. If the resistance persists, the beta cells will lead to pancreatic beta cell failure and decreased insulin secretion, chronic hyperglycemia, and officially type 2 diabetes mellitus. Both types of diabetes have genetic components. Type 1 diabetes is associated with mutations in human lymphocyte antigens, specifically HLA-DR3 and HLA-DR4, but with a relatively weak inheritance. Type 2 diabetes has a stronger genetic component, and its identical twin concordance rate is around 70 to 90%. Another significant difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes is body weight, especially body fat, because type 2 diabetes has a strong correlation with metabolic syndrome. Patients are often overweight or obese, whereas patients with type 1 diabetes are usually thin. Visceral or abdominal fat seems to be particularly important in type 2 diabetes, perhaps more than the patient's overall weight. Now, let's try a pop quiz exercise to compare and contrast the different types of diabetes mellitus. Which type of diabetes is caused by a viral immune destruction of the pancreatic beta cells? Type 1 diabetes. Also remember, type 2 diabetes is caused by insulin resistance. Okay, next. Which type of diabetes is associated with obesity? Type 2 diabetes is associated with obesity, and historically, type 1 diabetes patients are thin and suffer weight loss at the time of diagnosis. And which type of diabetes has a stronger genetic predisposition? Type 2 diabetes has a strong polygenic predisposition. And which type of diabetes has a correlation with the HLA system? Remember that type 1 diabetes has a correlation with HLA-DR3 and HLA-DR4. Okay, last one. How are the pancreatic islet cells affected in type 1 differently than they are in type 2 diabetes? In type 1 diabetes, the islet cells are destroyed by an autoimmune reaction. And in type 2, the islet cells secrete less insulin, but they are present and not destroyed. Part 3. Clinical presentation of diabetes. Hyperglycemia typically presents with polyuria, polydipsia, and polyphagia. The excess glucose in the bloodstream causes hyperglycemia, and the high levels of glucose are filtered into the tubules of the kidneys, drawing water with it and causing polyuria in a process called osmotic diuresis. The patient then gets thirsty, causing polydipsia. Because glucose cannot enter cells, there is often a feeling of low energy and increased appetite, polyphagia, especially in type 1 diabetes. Chronic hyperglycemia over 5 to 10 years causes many systemic effects by the process of non-enzymatic glycosylation, when glucose attaches to proteins without the help of an enzyme. This leads to vascular damage in many different tissues, including the retina, kidneys, and nerves. In the short run, hyperglycemia also leads to irreversible glycosylation of the hemoglobin in the red blood cells to form hemoglobin A1C, an important diagnostic test for diabetes that is used to assess the patient's average glucose levels. A quick way to recall the presentation for diabetes, it's called the three P's of diabetes: polyphagia, or hunger due to hyperglycemia, polyuria, and polydipsia. Time for another quick question. What is the name of the process by which glucose enters and damages tissues in the body? Non-enzymatic glycosylation. Okay, so what makes diabetes such a serious problem? A patient with diabetes can face so many issues that we organize them here as chronic and acute complications and accompanying comorbidities. Let's first discuss some chronic complications of diabetes. The ultimate goal for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes management is avoiding the long-term chronic complications that occur because of hyperglycemia. These include vascular complications such as retinal damage, kidney failure, peripheral nerve disease, autonomic nerve disease causing orthostatic hypotension and nausea and vomiting, and cardiovascular disease. The most effective way to prevent most of these complications is to establish excellent control of the serum glucose early in the disease course and to maintain it long term. Urine albumin levels test for kidney damage, and regular eye exams by an ophthalmologist can help detect microvascular complications of the eye. In addition, foot exams and neurologic tests help gauge the degree of neurologic and circulatory damage that the hyperglycemia has caused. Patients also benefit from the use of statins to prevent and treat symptoms of cardiovascular disease. Let's pause here for another question. What is one of the ways to screen for kidney disease in a patient with diabetes mellitus? Check urine albumin levels. Moving on, let's now talk about the acute complications of diabetes. Besides the chronic complications, both types of diabetes mellitus can also cause acute complications that may be set off by another illness, like an infection or a myocardial infarction. The stress leads to severe hyperglycemia and other disorders. The disorders are termed diabetic ketoacidosis, also called DKA, and hyperglycemic hyperosmolar nonketotic syndrome, also called HHNS. Both can be fatal if left untreated. DKA is more common in patients with type 1 diabetes and is caused by the lack of insulin combined with stress. The lack of insulin leads to increased lipolysis, a conversion of triglycerides to free fatty acids, which are metabolized in the liver to keto acids. This leads to hyperglycemia and metabolic acidosis. HHNS, in contrast, is more common in patients with type 2 diabetes and is characterized by extremely high blood sugar levels without ketosis because insulin is present. Now, let's compare the signs and symptoms of HHNS and DKA. First, the onset for HHNS can occur over days to weeks, while in DKA, the onset of symptoms usually takes hours to a few days. Patients with HHNS usually present with some sort of neurologic symptom and are less likely to have symptoms associated with breathing or abdominal pain. While with DKA, their main presenting symptoms will be abdominal pain and deep respirations, also called Kussmaul pattern breathing. Diabetic ketoacidosis obviously presents with elevated ketones in the urine and a low serum pH, as the name suggests. And HHNS is not associated with ketones or any acid-based disturbance. Finally, both HHNS and DKA patients will be volume depleted and require aggressive volume resuscitation with isotonic fluids early in the disease process. Many comorbidities are related to obesity, including hypertension and hyperlipidemia. The changes of the lipid metabolism lead to higher incidence of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, while increased fat around the neck can cause obstructive sleep apnea. There have also been recent studies that found links between diabetes mellitus and some form of cancer. Part 4. How is diabetes mellitus diagnosed? In addition to noting the characteristic symptoms of diabetes mellitus, physicians use various glucose tests to make a diagnosis of either type of diabetes. Any abnormal value in any of the following four tests is a strong indicator of the presence of diabetes. First, a fasting blood glucose greater than or equal to 126 mg per deciliter on two separate occasions. Second, a random glucose value greater than or equal to 200 mg per deciliter in a patient exhibiting signs and symptoms of diabetes. Third, the less frequently used approach of an oral glucose tolerance test, where patients are given a large concentration of a sugary drink by mouth. If the results are greater than or equal to 200 mg per deciliter 2 hours after ingestion, diabetes is strongly indicated. And fourth, and the most widely used today in type 2 diabetes, is the use of the glycated hemoglobin or hemoglobin A1C value of greater than or equal to 6.5%. It can also be used in type 1 diabetes, but is still a bit controversial. In the absence of unequivocal hyperglycemia, results should be confirmed by repeating testing before making a diagnosis of diabetes mellitus. Hemoglobin A1C levels track glucose levels over an extended period. Hemoglobin A1C results when glucose attaches to hemoglobin by non-enzymatic glycosylation in a high glucose environment. Because the glycosylated hemoglobin remains in the body until red cell turnover occurs, every 120 days, hemoglobin A1C is useful for tracking how well patients regulate their glucose levels over time. As stated, it may also be used for the initial diagnosis. So how can you tell the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes in uncertain cases? The clinical distinction of the two types of diabetes is usually straightforward, given the differences in age, tendency to ketoacidosis, and body weight. But in some patients, particularly children, the diagnosis may be uncertain after the initial evaluation. Two lab tests are useful in these circumstances. The connecting peptide, or C-peptide, is a short 31 amino acid polypeptide that connects proinsulin's alpha chain to its beta chain. C-peptide is cleaved from proinsulin as it becomes insulin. C-peptide is stored with insulin in the pancreatic beta cells, and it is released when insulin is released. A patient with type 2 diabetes still has endogenous insulin produced by the cell's protein manufacturing machinery and will have C-peptide in their bloodstream, whereas a patient with type 1 diabetes will have low or absent C-peptide levels because they make very little insulin. A quick way to remember how C-peptide helps you is to use this mnemonic. C-peptide helps you see how much insulin is in the body. How about one more quick quiz? Why is C-peptide low or absent in patients with type 1 diabetes? C-peptide is cleaved from proinsulin as it becomes insulin. Because patients with type 1 diabetes do not produce insulin, they do not produce C-peptide. Lastly, I'll briefly touch upon antibody tests. Type 1 diabetes often presents with autoantibodies directed against various aspects of the endocrine pancreas. Some examples include glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies and islet cell cytoplasmic autoantibodies. These antibodies are present in more than 85% of individuals with type 1 diabetes and only 5 to 10% of patients with type 2 diabetes. Part 5. How do we treat diabetes mellitus? Both types of diabetes benefit from a balanced diet, high in fiber and low in both fat and refined simple carbohydrates like sucrose and fructose. The highly restricted low-carb diets of the past are no longer recommended for most patients. Type 1 diabetes mellitus is typically managed with insulin replacement therapy because most patients have little to no endogenous insulin production. There are many different preparations of insulin available, including long-acting, intermediate, and short-acting types. All run the risk of hypoglycemia, and therapy must be followed by multiple daily fingerstick glucose checks. Alternatively, installed insulin pumps automatically adjust insulin dosing using blood sensors. Pancreatic islet cell transplant may also be an option for some patients with type 1 diabetes. In contrast, type 2 diabetes mellitus is typically managed by exercise, weight loss, and oral hypoglycemic medications. If weight loss is not effective, patients often start taking medications to lower their glucose levels. These drugs lower glucose levels through a variety of mechanisms, including increased insulin release, increased urinary glucose excretion, and decreased insulin resistance. There are numerous drugs available, but metformin is typically the first one prescribed. It is also important to note that some patients with long-standing type 2 diabetes may eventually require insulin therapy if it cannot be controlled with diet and multiple oral agents. And that brings us to the end of our discussion of diabetes mellitus foundations and frameworks. Now, let's recap to see if we've completed our goals. First, can you define type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus by comparing and contrasting their pathophysiology? Patients with type 1 diabetes have a lack of insulin production due to the destruction of pancreatic beta cells that leads to hyperglycemia. While patients with type 2 diabetes are usually obese and suffer from an insulin resistance, where the body's cells are not able to respond to insulin, leading to hyperglycemia. Second, what are the three hallmark signs and symptoms of hyperglycemia? The three P's of hyperglycemia include polydipsia, polyuria, and polyphagia. Third, can you compare and contrast diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, and hyperglycemic hyperosmolar nonketotic syndrome, or HHNS? Both conditions are present with hypovolemia and significant hyperglycemia, but patients with DKA will present within hours to days with an acidosis and ketones present in the urine and abdominal pain with deep breathing or Kussmaul breathing pattern. Patients with HHNS will present days to weeks with more neurologic symptoms and no acidosis or ketones present. Next, can you describe a laboratory test that can help you distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus? A C-peptide level can help you distinguish type 1 from type 2 diabetes, because it would be low in type 1 as it is in low in patients with little or no insulin production. You can also consider antibody testing to establish an autoimmune disruption of the pancreatic beta cells, which is also consistent with type 1 diabetes. Finally, can you compare and contrast management principles for type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus? Due to the lack of insulin in type 1 diabetes, insulin is indicated at the outset of type 1. Oral hypoglycemic agents are the cornerstone of treatment for type 2 diabetes. Traditionally, metformin is the first agent. And that's it. Armed with your newfound knowledge of diabetes mellitus, let's get back to the patient from the beginning of this episode. You are seeing a 13-year-old previously healthy boy that recently has been experiencing decreased exercise tolerance, polyuria, polydipsia, and polyphagia. You found that your patient's blood glucose level was 287 and his urine dipstick was positive for glucose. You explained to your patient and his parents that he has type 1 diabetes. You described the basics of dietary modifications, checking blood sugars, and insulin therapy. His father interjects, "My boss at work just takes a pill." You explain that with type 1 diabetes, insulin is the best treatment, as it is caused by a lack of pancreatic insulin secretion rather than a resistance to insulin, as in the case of type 2 diabetes. You arrange a hospital observation admission for more intensive education and initiation of insulin therapy, and make plans to bring him back to the clinic in a few days. And that's it for our show. Make sure you like and subscribe if you like what you hear, and remember, your feedback helps us to improve. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmole-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time,